In honor of the 75th anniversary of Walt Disney's first feature-length film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, Weldon Owen is releasing a collection that chronicles the complete making of the groundbreaking film. The film was first shown to a theatrical audience in December 1937, brought overwhelming joyous applause from a house full of hardened film industry professionals. From today's perspective, its stature is even greater, named as one of the best movies of all time by the American Film Institute and still beloved by children and adults around the world. J.B. Kaufman spent years researching the film's history, interviewing participants, and studying the marvelous archival art that appears in the pages of the book. The book is the fairest one of all, the making of Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and J.B. Kaufman joins us on the telephone this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
It is wonderful to have you here. As I mentioned in the introduction, you are an author and film historian on the staff of the Walt Disney Family Foundation. So what exactly is that gig?
Well, it takes in several things. It started out basically with these book projects that I was working on with them. But at that time, they were also working on starting the Walt Disney Family Museum here in San Francisco. And so one thing led to another, and I wound up doing some of the writing for the museum as well. And now it covers a variety of things. But my main occupation actually is these books on Disney film history.
Now, I would assume, and maybe I'm assuming this incorrectly, but I would assume that if there is a tidbit of information to be found, that the Walt Disney Archive should have it, right?
For the most part, yes. They've done a wonderful job of preserving the history of the studio. And but the only thing is, there is a lot of that history to preserve. And so you should never assume that everything has been accounted for, because every now and then there are always new surprises that crop up.
In fact,
we have a few of them in the collection of the museum here.
What would be a surprise, for example?
Well, for example, Ward Kimball, the great animator,
yeah,
who worked at the studio for many years and who was really kind of winning his spurs at the time of Snow White, his collection was donated here at the museum. And it turns out that he saved a lot of production papers, including some that related to scenes that he animated that then did not appear in the film. So you can always find little scraps of information like that that add to the overall total.
Give us a sense of at what point this started to, this project, the Snow White project, started to be on Walt Disney's radar.
Well, according to him, he started getting serious about the idea of making a feature as early as 1933, and in fact, we know that he was thinking about it, because he talked to some people in the trade press about it. But the idea kind of slowly crystallized, and it was roughly, I would say, early to mid 1934 that he and his staff seriously started working on the story of Snow White.
How much of that original idea ended up being the final film? In the sense of, was there a journey along the way, or was it pretty much, did he realize the dream that he had?
Well, the overall vision, I think, was there from the beginning, but it's amazing how much of a journey there was, actually, because when you start going through the story conference transcripts and so on, it is pretty evident that he and his writers and artists were open to any and every idea. They came up with an amazing wealth of possible story material before they finally narrowed it all down to the material that you actually see in the film. So there was quite an evolutionary process.
What was it, do you think, that worked with the audience? I mean, how much of it was the newness of it, and the fact that this was something that was so unprecedented, and how much of it was, what has become to be known as the Disney magic?
Well, that's a very good question, because it's true that he could have coasted quite a while there just on the novelty value of what he was doing. But in fact, I think it's a real testament to him as an artist and to the integrity of the artists working with him that they didn't settle for that. They kept refining and refining and improving. Because there's not a single scene in the film that appears on the screen as it was originally done. Every single thing was worked and reworked, and it's clear when you read the reviews that that people were just bowled over by how much farther he did go in creating this world of fantasy on the screen. As I say, at the time he could have got by with a lot less, but and he would have been the film would have been successful, but I don't think it would have been the enormous worldwide success that it was without that, because people fell in love with individual dwarfs and they went back to see it again and again and just were really overwhelmed with the beauty of this thing that he had created.
The when you look at the dwarfs, there was a dwarf Deffy. Is that true?
Yeah, there was. In fact, there were quite a few. The idea of naming the dwarfs after their traits, their personality traits,
right,
was part of the idea from the beginning.
And there were always going to be seven.
There were always going to be seven, but there were a lot of candidates for those seven jobs. And in fact, I think at one point there were over 50 names that were considered, and Deffy was one of the last holdouts who ultimately didn't make the cut. He was deaf, and he was constantly having to have things explained to him, and it was funny for a while. But I think maybe one of the reasons they dropped Deffy was that it probably started to slow the story down, because every time anything happened, he couldn't understand it and had to have it explained to him.
And when they became, so at what point late in the production, it seems in the book, where these characters really started to take on very distinct personalities and their features, their facial features and how they would be drawn became quite quite clear, and then because you look at it individually and then they start to come together and there is that family-like look, isn't there?
Yes, there is. The dwarfs were really a textbook exercise in what they called personality animation at the Disney studio, and that was one of their great breakthroughs of the 1930s, to convey a character's personality not only by the dialogue and the things the character does, but by the way the character moves, because you can tell a lot about somebody and about their mood and their personality and so on just by the way they move.
What do you think there is about this film that has been so so everlasting for us as an audience, in the sense that, you know, in many things we become hardened and we like the new, and we kind of cast aside. There are the classics and there's a nostalgia factor, but to bring in new audiences and for this film to be as resonant with a 3 or 4 year old watching it in their living room on Blu-ray really speaks to the power of the film itself.
It really does, and some people might think I'm a little biased about this, but I really think that Walt's efforts to build an element of timelessness into the film really, really succeeded. You know, I think initially the idea was that he knew it was going to take a long time to finish the film. It took about 4 years altogether. And so if you start with something that's very current and up to the minute, if the film isn't finished until 4 years later, then it's already going to be obsolete by the time you finish it.
Mm.
So in one way it was a purely practical consideration. But I think he also loved the idea of preserving that feeling of timelessness on the screen. So So that was a very deliberate thing, and there was a lot of analysis and a lot of work that went into creating that. On another level, I think that for the music, for example, the songs in the film are still part of this, the classic American songbook, and in a way they do achieve that timeless quality. But in another way, I think personally, I think that they are grounded in the popular music world of the 1930s, which was the golden age of American songwriting.
Mm.
So there are several layers there that I think combine to give the film an appeal that just keeps going.
One of the things that can't be understated, of course, is just the sheer beauty of the film. I mean, you see this in the book through many of the images, but there is such a color and a lushness to it that the film is just physically beautiful.
Oh, no question. No question. You won't get any argument from me on that. It's a thing of beauty.
And when you look at 75 years and how it's lasted, when you put something like this together, I assume there's still things to learn about it.
Oh, absolutely. It's in fact, working on this book was just it's been a real blessing in my life to be able to do this, because it's a big project, and I think that I'm a film historian, and I've dealt a lot with silent films, and in a lot of that work, your challenge is to try to scrape together any little bits of information you can find to piece together the story behind the film. With Snow White, there was such an amazing wealth of information at the archives and at the museum and in other locations that the real challenge was to dig through this mountain of research material and get some kind of meaningful perspective on it. So, there were many discoveries, and it was just a constantly surprising thing. And we owe a lot to the studio, not only for producing the film, but for preserving the documentation of how it was made.
The name of the book is The Fairest One of All, The Making of Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. J.B. Kaufman, I thank you very much for being with us. Best of luck to you.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much. Again, the name of the book, The Fairest One of All. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.